Welcome back to Between the Covers on WMKY. I'm Jennifer Rice, along with Susan Thomas. The book we will be discussing today is The Circle by Dave Eggers.
When Mae Holland is hired to work for The Circle, the world's most powerful internet company, she feels she's been given the opportunity of a lifetime. So we'll find out, was she or not? It's a heart-racing novel of suspense, questions about memory, history, privacy, democracy, control, and the limits of human knowledge. So let's introduce our guest today. Joining us is Sasha Reinhardt.
I live here in Moorhead. I'm an 8th grade language arts teacher, and I help do social media for Coffee Tree Books.
I'm April Hobbs-Nutter. I'm the web marketing director at Moorhead State University, and I'm here because social media is a big part of my job in marketing and doing social media for the university. So hopefully I'll bring a unique perspective.
I'm Tony Hobbs. I am the Director of Creative and Branding Services for Moorhead State, and I've been using computers and social media since before I could walk, pretty much. And social media for me has been my biggest escape, my connection to the world. So that's why I'm here.
I'm Stephen Middleton. I'm a faculty member in the Department of Communication, Media, and Leadership Studies. I worked along with our department chair, Dr. Keith Terry, to draft the social media minor, which will be implemented in the fall semester.
Well, fantastic. We're all so happy that you're joining us. We're going to be able to bring a lot of different perspectives to this book. When I was reading reviews of this book, you know, I was interested to see that it was, there were some people who really liked it. There are some people who were, as we learned in the book, sort of meh about it. Because my husband and I both actually like fought over reading this book because we were so entranced by it. And, you know, the LA Times talked about it as being successful as a commentary on big data and transparency. And so I was just wondering sort of, do you think the book was successful, and if so, you know, how, or perhaps not?
I think it was successful in that regard. It certainly made me reconsider how I present myself on Facebook, what I share, what I like, and not just Facebook, Twitter, which is even more open in some ways. And it made me think about how I use social media professionally versus personally, and how those two things, for me, are very different.
Yeah, it's similar with me, only I think I ended up, as a result of the book, I use it more now than I did before I read it. So
that's why you're here, Tony, because you said, I love The Circle. The rest of us were afraid, but Tony loves The Circle.
Yeah, that's interesting. I gave up Facebook for Lent, and that sounds really funny, and people always laugh when I say that, but it was really... it was an addiction for me. Like, I would find myself, instead of carrying a book with me, like I'd done all my life when I would be waiting, you know, at the doctor's office, I would have my phone out and just be endlessly scrolling, and I didn't want to turn into that person, you know? So after reading that book and then being off of Facebook for 40 days, I was very reluctant to rejoin that world, The Circle.
Well, Sasha, my husband actually disabled his Facebook after reading this book. Yeah. So he's not quite off of it yet, but pretty close. What did you think, Steve?
Well, I thought a lot about social media, and one of the things I've always noticed with the students, especially in the larger section courses in communication, I sometimes creep in a way, look at what they're doing on their phones, because, you know, it's just a sea of people looking at their phones all times on campus. And generally they're on Facebook or Twitter. And so I thought about that a lot when I read the book and how plugged in not just young people, but people today are, and the role sort of this plays. And this is our future. When we started working with the social media minor, it was amazing at this sort of budding field of study that's coming from social media marketing, and the world is taking notice. And so it made me think a lot about that. And I've never really had that much of a presence in social media. I'm not witty enough to have Twitter. I don't think I find Instagram a bit much when I'm out with people. They're taking pictures of their food and things. But it made me think a little bit more about why people are so interested in social media.
Well, and this is Jennifer again. Like April mentioned, when I read the book, I did not cancel my Facebook account like my husband did. I did what Tony actually did is I increased it, but I increased my use of it as from a professional perspective because I saw, you know, this is not a free service. They are taking from you. And so if you are going to be taken from, you better be getting something back from it. Mm-hmm. So that's the way that it sort of changed my interfacing.
Well, it's a little more than they're taking from you. You're giving freely. They're not really taking. You're really putting it all out there, this content.
And I think that's an important thing to mention, Susan. People don't realize that putting things out there, you think you're sharing this with your friends. We're friends on Facebook. I share a picture of something and I say, I liked this movie. But when you actually like things and follow people on Facebook, that's tracked. And I know from my professional experience, if I design a Facebook ad for Morehead State University, I can look at demographics. And that doesn't just mean gender and age. That means people who like this movie, people who have an interest in this whatever topic, you know, which is helpful in ad placement, but that's why you see the things you see on Facebook. And I think a lot of people, they don't think about that. They're connected to their family and they see something, oh, I like this. You don't realize that information can be used and not that it's malicious necessarily to be advertising to people based on things they like. Hopefully that's a good thing. They're seeing things that they're interested in. But I guess the question always comes, where's that line and how does that...
Okay, well, that raises something in the book because there were lots of things that, okay, seeing ads and things that you're interested in, you said, that's a good thing. There are lots of things in the book that seem like they're a good thing, but then the reality of it, when you're only seeing that, you're limited in your choices. It becomes sort of not so good.
The book starts out with May, and May's definitely sort of an ingenue who feels that she's landed in heaven. And she starts out at a very lowly place that they call customer experience, but is really customer, representation or, you know, what customer experience, I believe, is what they refer to it as. And she rises up through the ranks. And then there is a point in time where things shift. And I believe from sort of a utopian sort of novel to a dystopian novel. So I was wondering, did you feel that same way? And sort of when did you feel that shift happen?
When I read the first couple pages, I thought, oh my goodness, this is me. This is how I would feel. And I think we all can probably relate back to maybe the first job you got that you really liked. And you think, this is going to be really, you know, something I'm committed to. I'm putting everything into this. It's not just work, it's passion. And that really resonated with me. But then as it went along, I thought, oh no, she's drunk the Kool-Aid and this is going to be trouble. Because you start to see that she's comfortable and they keep adding things on and more stuff and she's still comfortable. And I guess that happens to all of us. You know, you get chipped away at little by little. But to see that happen to someone, she remains positive and happy about 95% of what's going on. There's this little question in the back of her mind, but every time it pops up, she sort of says, that's okay.
But why is she comfortable with it? Because it's the circle?
And I think so.
And the word we haven't said yet is Google. You know, it's the ultimate.
Well, and because they are doing some very good things.
On one side.
You know, if I ask you, do you support transparency in government? Everyone in here would say yes. But if I ask you, would you be okay with politicians wearing a camera on their chest all the time? We might say, well, maybe in political meetings, there's some things I don't need to see. Or maybe you would say all the time. But then what if I said, Steve, would you like to wear a camera all the time?
I'd say no.
Yes.
And the circle would say secrets are lies.
That's right.
They would say you're hiding something.
If you don't have anything to hide, then...
And why would you not share your experience with the world? The world could learn from your experience.
You're being selfish if you don't share. Yes.
Exactly.
Well, that one place in the book, when it finally... It turned into this ugly amalgamation of Apple, you know, with the whole presentation and the Steve Jobs-like figure, and everybody's like, oh, what are they unveiling? And then Google... and Twitter and Facebook, and they just turn into this big ugly blob. But on 68, where it says, all that happens must be known, and it's just like flashing up on the screen the whole time he's talking. And then he goes into, I'm not giving away too much here, don't worry, but it goes into the cameras that he set up in, is it his mom's house, so he can check on her. And they see her walking around in her towel, and he's like, oh, let's drop that one. But that moment was just like, that's too much. It's too creepy. And that idea that just because something exists and you have that knowledge, that means I have the right to have that knowledge, it's just a bit too far.
The one area where she misses the Portuguese-themed dinner or luncheon and was kind of reprimanded for not being, you know, in the know, so to speak, kind of removed from everything, actually reminded me of a friend of mine who works on campus that will remain nameless. But when they first got their job, you know, they're plugged in 24/7. They would get emails at 2 a.m. and expected to respond, and messages and you know, phone calls and things, and they were kind of always plugged in. And that's the world we live in now with social media, and especially with a lot of work and jobs that tie us to, especially if we have smartphones.
You think the expectation now is that people are,
yes, I
are
do.
Respond when they are,
that's right,
when they are summoned,
yeah,
whether phone, whether yeah, it's,
if your job pays for your phone, your service, yeah, that's all part of it now.
Tony, was there a part in the book that it tipped, or were you sort of like on board, this is a good thing, through the whole book?
Well, I mean, realistically, I can understand that whoever is in control of the circle has a lot of power. So I'm not blind to that fact. But for me, having access to knowledge was exciting because, you know, we grew up in Eastern Kentucky. We were, well, according to our internet provider, we were the first house in 2 counties to have the internet. So for me, being Tony growing up on Big Andy Ridge, this idea of the internet was amazing. I had a question, I didn't have to ask my big sister, I could find out on the net. If I had something I wanted to know, I had access to it. If I wanted to understand how someone lives, if they're reading the Quran versus the Bible, well, I didn't have to just accept what I was told. I could look that up. So for me, it was exciting, this idea of everything that can be known should be. Why not? Why shouldn't we have access to that? If you know something, why can't I know that? Obviously, there are some parts of the book that are a little personal. I think for me, the part of the book that really shifted, it wasn't the circle's fault, in my opinion, it was personal flaws, was her romantic encounter, and that was recorded without her knowledge. Or she wasn't really thinking, oh, this might be recorded and then I can't get rid of it. So for me, I was like, yeah, I think it would definitely force you to, well, it already does. I mean, I'm more wary of who I hang out with, who's tagging me. You know, I have those settings on Facebook, not because I'm mean, but I don't want just anybody to tag me, or I don't want just anyone to be able to upload something.
So you do want some control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, one of the things in the book, the piece of technology that was the big unveiling was the lollipop camera.
Mm-hmm.
And how great would that be? You can plant one at the beach. You can see what the tides look like. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Until, oh, there's one in the bedroom, mm-hmm, with my new boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so for me, that was kind of, obviously there for me is some limit, but overall I would take the technology and the knowledge over privacy. That's me. And that's why I'm the lone read over here.
I think the big difference between the circle and other sort of contemporary and real examples of corporations that we have now is that it is voluntary now, and the circle, as they go to completing the circle, becomes involuntary and necessary if you want to be a citizen. There is no opting out. And I think that was a big sort of takeaway from the book. Where's that line between are you able to choose, or is this against your will?
One other thing for me as far as privacy goes, and maybe it's just because it's me, but you know, I'm used to people being involved in my personal life. People are always either asking questions or talking about what I do and who I'm with and who I'm dating or whatever. So for me, I'm already used to that not being private. So my private life is not private already. So I just take it on the offense. I'm like, I'll put it out there then. You know, this is what I do. This is what I'm eating. I like this, and you should eat this, and you should try this, and that's a really awesome recipe. Or, you know, whatever, politically, religious, I head it off before, you know, people, there's not really much to gossip about because it's already out there. I don't care.
Well, as Tony was saying, speaking of preferences, a few weeks in or a month or so into the circle, I might be a little off with my timeline, she gets tabbed as one of the circlers to wear a headset, add yet another screen to her already dozen screens that are crowding her desk. And so she will get prompted to smile, frown, or meh at her preferences for various things. And what did you think about that? Because it really, personally, it really changed my opinion about taking surveys.
You know, you never really know when you take an online survey who's actually going to see the results. And one of the issues with teaching online classes is you can't do a traditional survey, and you have to use a Survey Monkey type website. And I'm always really afraid who's seeing that. And I think sometimes the people taking that think that. But yeah, I've always been kind of leery about surveys. But you know, you're always dangled with the carrot of a free iPad or something. So you.
But even the rating, you buy something online, rate this product.
Embedded cookies, and then they use you for advertising later.
See, I don't think any of that stuff bothers me as much as how personal it gets. Like that, the image that I mentioned before of his mom is just like embedded in my head. And then as a middle school teacher, I see like the personal effects of it a whole lot more. And that's what resonates with me more than like the advertising and stuff we choose to share. It's how people are affected when they don't choose to share, and it ends up being out there anyway.
Well, it's time for a break, but when we return, we'll continue our discussion of The Circle by Dave Eggers. You are listening to Between the Covers on WMKY. Welcome back to Between the Covers on WMKY. I'm Jennifer Rice, and joining me is Susan Thomas. The book we are discussing today is called The Circle by Dave Eggers. And when I was rereading the book, I got to the scene that I'd actually forgotten about Mercer before he drove his truck off the bridge, and how there were drones that were swooping around him and then had attached to his truck. And that was a really horrifying scene. So any comments on the use of drones or
I've used a drone before doing some video work.
And you weren't fined by the FAA.
No, it's a very fine line. How quickly and it, well, first of all, camera technology has gotten so small and so great at the same time. You can see such wonderful colors and quality, and you know, why not see if you can get an overhead shot, something that would have taken you $500,000 to do, you know, 15 years ago. Now you can do for, you know, less than $1,000, you know, buy a little drone, buy a GoPro camera. And it's been controversial, and I can understand that. You know, if you have a nosy neighbor, it's flying over and trying to spy on you. It's very controversial in the video industry now. And also, Amazon's CEO says Amazon's going to start delivering packages via drone very soon, possibly in the
That's
next
what they announced.
4 or 5 years. So it's interesting, but at the same time, I think it's also an example of how technology has gotten, you know, has increased so rapidly in such a small amount of time. But yeah, I can understand the privacy issues with drones.
I think it's an example of how anything good can be maligned. I mean, the technology is there, and I think it's incredible that you can do a documentary film and get shots that you couldn't have afforded without a helicopter or an airplane. But on the other hand, I don't want a drone in my yard. And I will probably shoot it if it comes in my yard or throw things at it. But it's like any technology, and I think that is the difficult challenge that we all have, and especially in working with students, you're teaching them about technology and teaching them with technology and the good potential that is there. But when has it gone too far? And I guess for me, the assumptions I have about human nature is that it will always go too far. But that's not a reason not to use it and not to at least try.
Yes, we should explore this technology. It will lead to something else. You know, our grandmother had Alzheimer's. I really wouldn't want everyone else to be witnessing that. But if they're going through it, you know, there's that fine line of...
It's like the nanny cam.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a parent and you don't really know your babysitter, okay, maybe. But if you're the babysitter, that's pretty insulting.
Mm-hmm.
That's a relationship ender, I think.
And I think it has to do with who's watching and who's being watched. We're okay with other people being watched, but at least for me, I'm not okay with me being watched.
And certainly not without your...
Without my permission. Absolutely. But, I know if I know there's a security camera in a store, fine. That's okay. I know it's there. I'm not doing anything I shouldn't be doing. But wearing a camera, no.
Many of the things like the facial recognition, the scanning in of the pictures to create their past perfect software is that the Circle executives, especially May's friend Annie, who, you know, when the book is introduced, you know, Annie is this supercharged, the gang of 40, you know, she's up on the hierarchy level, and then she participates in Past Perfect and basically implodes because she finds out some very nasty things about her family, a family that they were actually very waspy and hospital corners, and basically sent her into a coma.
She had a nervous breakdown.
Yep.
And that facial recognition software is out there right now.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. They're working on it. There was just an article about, you know, for terrorists and
that. Even for social media, you know, Facebook can say, I think this picture is of April Nutter.
Yep.
And, you know, then I have the option to say, yes, that's me, or no, that's not me.
Maybe, either one.
Depending
either
on
one.
How my settings are on Facebook. So I guess if we learn anything today, you'll be check your Facebook settings. But that is, to me, a little scary. I'm okay with it being used, you know, in airports to screen for what I perceive as bad people, whatever that means. But I don't want to be recognized, not even by Facebook.
Well, and that's one of those good, bad situations in the book. We have the, is it good to catch the bad guys? Everyone would say, of course. And then they go through it in record time, track down, I can't remember what the person had done. But
she was on the lam forever.
They tracked down a fugitive and with using facial recognition software, cornered her, and were fortunate with that it wasn't a mob scene since they had used social media to get all these people to round her up.
Yeah. Now, May's family is going through a pretty terrible healthcare crisis in the beginning of the book, and her father has MS, and they have terrible insurance. But because she works for the Circle, her parents are added on to her benefits package, and magically, her father gets the best health care he possibly can get, but in exchange for being constantly watched. So what did you all think about that?
Even I had some frustration with that. I guess I would have to regulate it. You can watch some of it. Okay, fine. It could be therapeutic to other people who are forced to be indoors. Maybe they can't get out to go to a support group, so they could at least be like, okay, this person's going through the same thing. Maybe we can log in and look online at this particular time. But for me, there would have to be a time that I could shut it off. I mean, there would have to be a balance. I think in this utopian, dystopian society, I can understand this thought of people that are homebound would want to connect. They could connect through video. It's not quite the same as being there, but it can get pretty close sometimes if you really miss someone or miss meeting up with them. I guess I would have to have some level of rule that I could shut it off.
Well, it was more than the cameras. He also got millions of zings and emails, and that he felt he had to respond, and people didn't understand why he hadn't responded. They had wished him well. Why would he not be grateful for their good wishes? And it became a burden.
I thought that was an interesting part, because certainly you want to wish someone well, but when you open something up that publicly, you know, somebody that's never met you, that's 1,000 miles away, that says, well, I hope you have a good day, maybe that means something, but you have no connection with this person, or, you know, maybe it's someone that has a similar disease or something like that. Those might be more meaningful, but just it being an open kind of environment where anybody could go watch what was going on with him and then comment to him or whatever, even if it's positive, that's an incredible burden to try to deal with and respond to. And I guess when it first kind of happened, I thought, oh, the doctors can keep an eye on him, and they may learn more about this disease. And that immediately was shut down by, no, anybody can go watch this. And that, to me, is not at all productive. I mean, I don't see how that's helpful. I appreciate if someone 1,000 miles away wishes me well, but not the same way that I would if someone that I'm connected to, that I know.
But if 15,000 people.
Yeah, and if 15,000.
Or
yeah, no.
50,000 or whatever the numbers were.
But I think that's the case with any sort of privacy and technology. There's such a fine line there between, you know, what you say is your privacy, and when that wall goes down, you're open to all of it. You know, you're exposed. And it's really hard to put limits on what your privacy is after that wall is down.
And for me, that kind of gets to that, the concept in the book of the true you, that you can't be anonymous online anymore. You know, a lot of people will have on Facebook, they have their birth date and they get lots of birthday recognitions. And I'm like, you use your real birthday on Facebook? You use your real birthday online for anything? I don't. Maybe I'm a little paranoid. I don't even use
the same birth year. Yeah.
I have an alternative that I use. I even have some alternative email addresses that I use when I really don't want something tied to my name. And I know that sounds paranoid, but sometimes you need to be anonymous. You want to go and, you know, maybe make a comment on something or look at something, and you don't want it connected to you or to your work or anything. And you know, for me, that was this true you business is really at the core of what's the scariest about this, is that you can't be anonymous. And then as the book progresses, you have to have this to participate in society. And for me, those two things, a certain amount of anonymity is a good thing. There are times when nobody needs to know it's you, because there are just some questions that you won't ask if you have to ask them as yourself, you know?
No, April, after reading this book, it does not seem paranoid.
So, Sasha, you know, being involved with young people, you know, they started out with True You, and then they went to True Youth with the chips being implanted. So what did you think, you know, working with kids when reading that?
My first thought is this would totally see no pushback whatsoever. My husband and I were talking just a few days ago about some of my students who, you know, had confided in me that they were dealing with bullying issues, which as an eighth grade teacher, you hear way more often than you would like if you're, you know, open to actually having the kids come talk to you. We were discussing the fact that there was no getting away from that experience anymore. Like when we were in school, and, you know, I'm not super old, but when I was in school back in my day, you could go home and at least have some retreat from people who were being mean to you or said awful things to you. And now it's like your phone is constantly dinging. People can text you. They can send you messages on Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat, which my students make fun of me because every time they mention Snapchat, I just rant. While they experience these bad things from the connectedness, I think there's also a part of them that really longs for it. So they're willing to take that bad side for
the good. Are
most of
your students on Facebook and Twitter?
Oh, yes. Not Facebook so much anymore. Facebook is for old people, in case you guys didn't know that. Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Vine. There's this one section that I've been looking at for the almost the duration of this whole conversation where Mercer and May are talking, and they're talking about how he's not online, and she said that her mind churned. Mercer was an underachiever, and an underachiever who somehow managed to be smug about it. And we all know those people who aren't on any social media. They're like, I'm not on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter. And then part of you is like you admire them, and then part of you is like, I don't know how you can do that. How can you function? But then on the flip side, the next page over, Mercer says it's created this new neediness that pervades everything, and that these tools actually manufacture unnatural social needs that weren't there before. And I see that so much with my students, because I didn't need that. I needed to disconnect when people were being mean to me all day and go home and sit in my PJs and watch He-Man, you know, and not have anybody bother me. But now there's that neediness that has to constantly be fed in one form or another.
Because if somebody's not texting them or tweeting, then they want to know why.
Exactly.
Well, there's that section where they go ahead and they do a company-wide vote. I think it's a smile or frown for May. And, like, the vast majority, like 99% of everyone's smiling. But she gets obsessed about the frowns. And when I was rereading the book, I realized how there was such a prevalent insecurity in both the people who worked at the circle and the users of the circle, this constant need for affirmation. I will say, when reading that part about Mercer, as somebody who uses social media to promote herself as an artist, I have a website, I actually have Instagram now and Pinterest because my web guy, who's very savvy, he's like, you got to do this. So I've been trying to streamline as much as possible. So when I was reading that, I thought, okay, Mercer, like, I understand you have your beliefs. Good luck making some money. Because, you know, you can, I do believe that you can opt in and kind of have most control. I know you don't have all control, but you can utilize the technology at this point as someone doing something artistic in order to make money. And it doesn't mean it has to get out of control. I mean, if you're booked up and you can't do anymore, you just say no. You know, you don't have to be a victim of it. So he was just a very adversarial, you know, character in the book.
But you don't think he could succeed without it?
Well, it just depends if he is tapped in. Could he succeed in Asheville, North Carolina? Probably. Could he succeed in the middle of, I don't know, let's just say New Mexico? Probably not. It basically, what access to social media and technology and having a website and that other stuff, what that does for artists, and it's especially important for artists like where we are in East Kentucky, there's not a giant pool of money here. There's not a high-end craft gallery in Moorhead, Kentucky that I can sell my work. So when someone pays $900-$1,200 for my work, guess what? They're not in Moorhead. They're probably not they're not in Eastern Kentucky. They're probably not in Kentucky. It's time for a break, but when we return, we'll continue our discussion of The Circle by Dave Eggers, and you are listening to Between the Covers on WMKY. Welcome back to Between the Covers on WMKY. I'm Jennifer Rice, and joining me is Susan Thomas. The book we are discussing today is The Circle by Dave Eggers.
Joining us on today's program is Sasha Reinhardt, April Hobbs-Netter, Tony Hobbs, and Stephen Middleton.
I get that a lot, that people think that you don't have connections with people online, but I just realized yesterday I was talking to someone on Facebook. We had been friends before there was Facebook. And it's like 17 years we've been friends. We've now met in person once. But, you know, I have several friends that I've been friends with online for 17, 18 years. They know more probably about me than a lot of people. So it is interesting to me, this.
But, thought. Tony, is that going to be more along the lines of, like, people, like, this sounds about old-time correspondence. I mean, like, you write letters to these people. I mean, you've had long, in-depth conversations over years. Mm-hmm. But do you think the majority of the interactions on social media have that kind of depth? Or are a lot of them just, like, quick, flipping through your thumbs up, smile, you know?
I find frown. That with people I don't know, I'm going to talk to them probably more than people I do know. Which is interesting because, at least with social media for me, I flip through Instagram. I don't really tweet very much because I get bored looking at it. Facebook for me, I look and can get lost in there because it's interesting. But I'm more likely to be quicker with people that I know than with people I don't know because I want to know what they're talking about.
So, Stephen, since you're in communications, what do you think? You know, as you spent a fair amount of time with this,
we don't communicate as much face to face, and that necessarily is not a bad thing. We could be communicating online. One of the things I've noticed in the 6 years I've worked here is there used to be large gatherings of students in the halls that would talk about the class and how bad they disliked the class, or you know. This discussion about college life in general, you don't have that anymore. You know, as soon as class is over, pretty much all during class, people are on their phone doing something. And as much as you try to reprimand and say not to, they're still going to do it. And as soon as class is over, the phones are out. So they're plugged in to something, to, you know, socially But the way we communicate is changing. You know, we're communicating behind screens. You know, you see the rise of cyberbullying. You know, you see the rise of what they call trolling, where people really value their opinions online. And I personally struggle with that. I'm a very fiercely private person. And, you know, you read comments. I've disabled comments on all the sites where I post videos because inevitably you're going to get a really negative comment from someone who may or may not know anything about what they're reviewing. But that's the world. That's the way people communicate behind screens. And, you know, just I like to kind of look over the shoulder and see what people are looking at on their phones because I'm just curious. You know, you somewhere someone has paid money for you to take a college class. And students have told me in the past, well, I pay out of pocket, so if I want to play on my phone, I should be able to. But there's somewhat of a point to that, but I see them bouncing around through social media just looking for something. And I don't, you know, if that's a community they're looking for or voice or something, but it's definitely changed the way we communicate.
I think that's interesting. And since I work on the Morehead State side of social media, we see we're a part of that community. And sometimes, you know, it is students sharing excitement about being here, especially prospective students a lot of times. Sharing photos, sometimes we do some contests, and it builds some engagement. I'm not going to pretend that that's the same as having a conversation with a prospective student. We hope that we will get that chance too. But I think it can be a good sense of community, but it is a little bit superficial. And to me, if it is a means of communication, but not the only means of communication, that can be a really good thing.
Well, I think there's also this really almost kind of backward element of control too when you only communicate online, because you can very much present yourself any way you wish, and what you share is very much what you want to share. So that in some cases could lend an extra element of depth, like Tony was saying earlier, where, you know, you would go more in depth with people you didn't know so well. Whereas people you do know already have all this background knowledge of you, and you can't control that.
Well, it's very much a persona. When you look at someone's Facebook profile, and I know that's the old person's social media, but it's very curated. You know, I have to say that when I was reading the book, some different parts of the book, May basically starts to have these little mini breakdowns where she's referring to the tear. And I think that the symbol, the tear, is her loneliness. About a year or two ago, the Atlantic Magazine, their cover story was about Facebook and loneliness. And so as April was saying, you know, it's great as a type of communication or a type of community, but it shouldn't be the only community, because she seems to constantly go in and fill the void. She goes into customer experience at 2 a.m. to fill the void. But it's this bottomless pit. It's never going to be filled by that. I thought that was an interesting reoccurring theme in the book, and how basically it can be addictive. I mean, they called it zings, but, you know, I have to admit, like, when I am posting images of, like, a new work in progress, I go on and I see if anyone liked it. You know, and then so, you know, 10 minutes later, you're hitting the refresh button.
Well, you know, we've talked about the social media aspect, technology, privacy, you know, sharing is caring, privacy is theft, secrets are lies. Those are the recurring themes in the book.
Well, I think she did have a private life coming into this, and I don't think she was prepared to give that up. She kept her parents fairly separate from her work, and she was okay with that. She didn't need them close for a lot of different reasons. And so I think I saw myself in her the first few chapters. I would have been excited about working at a Google-like place, but only to the point where it started to be that kind of drain, where it was a 24/7 job. That would have been just too much for me, too much of an introvert. I would have needed some time. That is really just me. No cameras, no lights, just me and the people that I led into that mini circle. You know, maybe she was a little questioning in the beginning, but she felt compelled to conform because she wanted to keep her job. She wanted to keep her friend Annie happy. She wanted to show people that, yeah, I'm from some podunk little town,
but I can do this. I can do this technology, and I can be good at it.
I'm good enough to work for the
Circle. I'm good enough to work here. So I have to keep showing that I'm good enough to work here. And it became, like Jennifer said, a bottomless pit of achievement and connection. Well, kind of fake connection, but online, you know, she just had to keep doing that. And so I think she went from being kind of like me to being more like, yeah, this is a good thing. I need to be like this. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure she kept her real self. We won't give away how it ends, but when you get to the ending, I wondered if that was how she really felt or if that was how she felt compelled to be.
I guess for me, I was mostly disappointed that she ended up with such a jerk. You know, like, my thought was, you have access to the Circle. You have access to everyone in the world, and you're going to end up with this loser. I mean, that's kind of how I saw it. So it was interesting to me that I thought she has access to limitless knowledge, limitless people. She's a superstar, basically, by this point. That was kind of a disappointment to me. I thought, yeah, she wouldn't settle. And I don't feel like someone in that position would have settled for whatever his name is. I don't remember.
Francis.
Yep. Yeah.
But see, I think her insecurity would let her settle for someone mm-hmm. like that. I have to say personally, and this is Jennifer here, the creepiest part of the end for me was when she started sort of her imagining how the Circle could develop technology where they could read her friend Annie's brain when she was in a coma.
I think it's the only way it could end, because I think human nature being what it is, most people probably would assimilate and accept the way things are and make the best of it, I guess.
Well, if she didn't go with it, then she would have to accept responsibility for Mercer.
Yeah. Everything about her life would completely change, and most people are not brave enough or strong enough to make that kind of a change. And I think she just said, well, I'm in this deep. Mm-hmm. I got to keep going and make the best of it. And I don't know how you do that personally, and I don't know how long she could sustain it. If there's a part two, she crashes and burns, or she goes underground in a year or less.
If we were to presume that this closing the Circle is bad, who of the three wise men do you think sort of the blame rests for that sort of hubris?
Well, I don't think it's just one. I think it takes all three, because any perfect storm has to have these kind of elements. And I thought they were really interesting characters. You had Eamon Bailey, who is Mr. Openness, Mr. Transparency, privacy is theft, everything should be known. But he's this very outgoing, he's the face of the Circle, and people want to know him. They want to be recognized by him, and so he's a very good character. And then you have Tom Stinton, who referred to himself as Capitalist Prime. He's seeing how we can make money out of this, you know, how we can...
He's the one with the shark.
And he's the one with the shark. And then you have Ty, who I think is the tragic character, but he has to be there. He came up with this great idea of how we could connect people and use technology to improve people's lives. But it's never that simple. Anything you can use for good, you can use for other things. And so I think it takes all three. I don't think the blame rests with any one of them. They all bear responsibility for what developed and how it developed and how they encouraged it. And, you know, some certainly encouraged certain parts more than others, maybe, but in the end, I think it took all three, and I blame all three.
Yeah, I would agree with that. For me, Calden is definitely not off the hook. Yeah, he now wants, oh, whoop, my bad, you know, he invented this, but I think you can't invent some of these things without thinking about the implications. You have to sort of understand, if I am messing with your privacy settings, I'm messing with your privacy settings, you know, so I think it's a little late for him to try to find redemption at that point.
It took more than one to sort of drive the ship, so to speak. And when, you know, there's such a fine line there with privacy in general. And once that once that was gone, you're open to everything. And so, yeah, I think all three, I have to agree with Tony and April, led to this together. It wasn't just one in particular. And I think that's what the character of Calden was trying to be, the savior, so to speak. And but at the same time, you know, they knew what was, he knew what was going on. He knew what would happen eventually. So,
do you think creators can see all the way down? You know, I mean, think of the technologies that we've had. The creator of the internet. I mean, do you think?
I had no.
They saw it would go to this point.
I don't know. I had no sympathy for Calden throughout, because I just saw, especially, didn't they mention he was always in a hoodie? And I just saw Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, ugh, I don't like you.
Well, there was a weird way he was always anonymous and sort of slinking in and slithering out. And
yeah. Part of that, though, too, I think he had become so stressed out. He had so much anxiety about what he had created and what it had become. His hair had gone completely gray, even though he was in his 30s, and it was, he wasn't being cool with the hoodie like some people are. But I think he was ashamed of where things had gone, and, you know, concerned about
too much
how it was going to end.
We're out of time for today's program. We've been discussing The Circle by Dave Eggers, published by Knopf. We want to thank our guests, Stephen Middleton, Tony Hobbs, April Hobbs-Netter, and Sasha Reinhart. I'm Susan Thomas.
And I'm Jennifer Rice. Thanks for joining us for this program of Between the Covers. For more information on this program or future books to be discussed, visit our Between the Covers page on Facebook. Ironically, this program was produced in the studios of WMKY at Morehead State University. Remember to support your local independently owned bookstore, and until next time, discover something new between the covers.